Okay, everyone, good evening. How are you? Wonderful. Great. Fantastic. Okay, good evening, everyone. My name is Yaakov Glasser. It's wonderful to be able to have a few minutes to learn with you tonight. Thank you for making the time to come out. I'm sure everybody has lots of things to do with you in finals or midterms or just general Yeshiva University stress of your lives. That's pretty much it. Okay, wonderful. It's amazing the difference between the audiences uptown and downtown. Like when you speak uptown, everybody's like, like there's nothing going on, like totally right. When you downtown, they're like, okay, give us something to write down. Give us something to write down. Is this on an exam? Is this? So I think that's wonderful, and God bless you all. I have three daughters, so I'm involved in a lot of drama. Okay, all right, great. So we find ourselves this week, this coming week, really in the next few days, we find ourselves in the period of the Jewish calendar where there's a fascinating convergence between a very ancient and traditional observance that we're all familiar with, which is Sfiras HaOmer, and a very contemporary religious experience, and that is Yom HaAtzmaut. And that's what I'd like to talk a little bit about tonight. Yom HaAtzmaut will be observed on Wednesday night. It's not Ha'ir, but because Ha'ir falls out a little bit later in the week, closer to Shabbos, we move it back. These days are a little bit somewhat flexible in terms of making sure that Chil Shabbos is okay. I'm the rabbi of the shul in Passaic, New Jersey. Yeah, any of you familiar with Passaic? It's a beautiful community. It's slightly to the right of God. And I decided that the Yom HaShoah program in our shul shouldn't be on Yom HaShoah because I was away for the last days of Pesach. I go away for the last days of Pesach. My father has one of these Pesach hotel companies. So when I got back, so first I did tshuva, and then I decided that the time had come. I have a special 40 minutes on Yom Kippur that I dedicate to everything I do the last days of Pesach. So so I decided that it was too soon to have a program. I wouldn't be able to push it over Shabbos. I wouldn't be able to, you know, to get everybody all inspired and want to come. So I pushed it to Sunday night. So I put out flyers all over the community saying Yom HaShoah was Sunday night. So in Passaic, they all think that Yom HaShoah was actually Sunday night. So I successfully moved the date. So these things are movable. It reminded me of when I first got to my shul. So it was a very small shul. It had like 20 or 30 families. Now it's Baruch Hashem. It's grown a lot. It's like 150, 160 families. But I had a lot of quirky things that we used to do in the shul. So one of the quirky things I used to do in the shul is, you know, there's a little paragraph right after Aleinu where you say Al Tira. You know what I'm talking about? So they used to say this paragraph, and it was a little bit weird. So people would come, and they'd see the shul, and they'd be like, what's happening? And Kaddish was off. So finally, one Shabbos, I got up, and I said, we're not going to do this anymore. And I quoted a Mishnah Berurah that had nothing to do with it. And then I told them, it's a little weird, and it's really not mutter to be weird. So anyway, this earned me some friends, and it earned another shul down the block some friends. But that Sunday, a guy came to the shul, and he wasn't there for Shabbos, for this very eloquent, YU rabbinic-trained approach with a lot of nuance and sensitivity. So he came up to me after davening, and he had been in the shul for many, many years, and he said, and on Sunday afternoon, we didn't say Al Tira. So he says to me, well, what happened to Al Tira? How come we're not saying Al Tira? So I said, we changed the minig of the shul. So he says to me, you know, it's not so easy to change the minig of a shul. I said, you know, it was pretty easy. I got up, I announced we were changing it, and that was the end of Al Tira, and that was the end of him in the shul. So the world, we're subject to minhagim. Different communities have different minhagim. Minhagim go in different directions. What I want to talk about tonight is to give us a little bit of a sense of connection to the experience of Sfiras HaOmer and the experience of Yom HaAtzmaut, or focused more so, we're not going to discuss politics tonight, but focused more so on the entire notion of our connection to the reality of the state of Israel in our contemporary Jewish experience, what we are living through in this generation, the great divine gift of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel. The Torah tells us, "Usfartim lachem imocharas haShabbos," that we count the days beginning from imocharas haShabbos. I just saw it on the shtender before me. Rabbi Bernstein gave a beautiful shiur here, where he tells you the difference whether or not it's d'oraisa, d'rabbanan. You can look at the Maariv Makomos. This is the mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer, and the mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer is intended to give expression to the entire notion of what freedom is all about in Judaism. Because Pesach, which celebrates the emancipation of Am Yisrael from the servitude of Mitzrayim, was the opportunity to live in liberty, the opportunity to live devoid of oppression. No longer would people direct us what to do with our time, with our energy, with our effort, with our families, with our children. But now there was a landscape of opportunity for people to be able to live not subject to the oppression of others, but based upon the way in which an individual wanted to direct their life. And this notion of liberty, that we are free of the oppression of others, is limiting in the world of Yahdus. We don't believe, as Rabbi Soloveitchik would say, in freedom from. Freedom from tyranny and freedom from oppression and freedom from slavery. We believe in freedom too. The notion that there is a fundamental connection between the day after the liberation from Mitzrayim. We go out of Mitzrayim, Mimokras HaShabbos, that's our Shabbos. That's our day of spiritual connection to the world. We leave Mitzrayim and then we begin the count. And that count takes us to the world of Shavuos, takes us to Kabbalas HaTorah, takes us to our mandate as a people in terms of what we're going to accomplish in this world. We don't believe in just being free to be free. We believe in freedom with a purpose. We believe in freedom that matters for something significant. And that's why, even though we're not ready to receive the Torah the day we walk out of Mitzrayim, simply our spiritual fortitude is lacking to be able to accommodate all of the myriad of expectations that the Torah is going to place on our lifestyle, on our ideology, on our belief system, on our theology, on the way in which we live our lives. We're not prepared for that, but we begin the count. We begin the count because there is a fundamental connection between the two experiences. That's the world of Sfiras HaOmer. And somewhat disruptive to this momentum of Sfiras HaOmer is the observance of a contemporary miracle that we experienced not so long ago, and that is the birth of the state of Israel. It has to be that somehow Hashkachas Hashem had some sort of intentionality that this moment of Jewish history, things that God does that do not happen at random. That's part of the whole message of Pesach, that the night of Pesach was chosen, it was predestined, with intentionality and with focus, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted this to be the night, Nisan to be the month, that freedom is not manifest in the larger orbits of divine power, in the months of Tishrei, in the months of Cheshvan, in the months of Kislev, that it is predisposed in the month of Nisan, and that is the month of freedom. And so therefore, if Nisan is the month of freedom, and Seder night is the month of the liberation of the Jewish people, then Sfiras HaOmer has something to say, has something to contribute, has something to color and to impact the experience of commemorating Yom HaAtzmaut. So that's what I'd like to talk about tonight. Why did this happen at this particular time? How do we give expression to our religious sensitivity in finding ourselves in the midst of this particular point in the Jewish calendar, in observance of this particular moment of Jewish history? How can we bring those two things together? So the whole notion that there is a religious dimension to the declaration of independence of the State of Israel, to the founding moments of the State of Israel, is in and of itself somewhat of a source of tension. We know, for all of us who have traveled to Israel, that the notion of the secular and the religious ability for these two communities to try to get along in being able to govern and being able to create a society and a state within which we could function is extremely complex. and often results in tremendous tension, even conflict. And we've all watched many, many times, many stories, many incidents, because at the end of the day, sometimes these compromises are impossible. By definition, we cannot accommodate a population of people who want the freedom of choice and opportunity to engage on Shabbos in any way that they so choose, in terms of giving expression to it as a day of rest, to be able to go to the movies, to be able to go to the mall, to be able to have a good time. We can't accommodate that and those who want to see a pristine religious environment that manifests the values and the observance of halacha at the same time. And so we know this is one of the great struggles of the contemporary Israeli experience. The antecedents to this moment actually existed in the very original moments of the creation of the state itself. And Golda Meir, who wrote an autobiography called My Life, right? She wrote of that day, her experiences that day. So take a look at source number two. Look at from the second paragraph. On the morning of May 14th, that's the day they declared the state of Israel, I participated in a meeting of the People's Council at which we were to decide on the name of the state. It wasn't so clear, as we're going to see a little bit later in the shiur, it wasn't so clear what the name of the state of Israel should be. And on the final formulation of the declaration, the name was less of a problem than the declaration, because there was a last minute argument about the inclusion of a reference to God. Actually, the issue had been brought up the day before. The very last sentence, as finally submitted to the small subcommittee. This mamish sounds like a shul board meeting, right? It mamish sounds like a bunch of guys got together and they're sitting there in the base medrash of some shul in Teaneck with a cup of coffee and they're trying to decide, you know, what the policy should be about bat mitzvahs. Like, that's mamish what it sounds like, right? So finally submitted to the small subcommittee charged with producing the final version of the proclamation, began with the words, "We trust in the Rock of Israel. We set our hands in witness to this proclamation." Ben-Gurion had hoped that the phrase Rock of Israel was sufficiently ambiguous to satisfy those Jews for whom it was inconceivable that the document which established the Jewish state should not contain any reference to God. Because he had all the frum people sitting there saying, we're going to declare the state of Israel the first moment of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel since the Bar Kokhba revolt, and we're not going to mention anywhere the name of God? That this whole experience and this whole reality is exclusively an outcome of Kochi Be'otzem Yadi, of the strength and the warriors and the tenacity and the geopolitical talents of the Jewish agency and the World Zionist Congress? That's what this is. There's no God in the declaration of the State of Israel. How could this be? So Ben-Gurion understood. He had constituents that felt that way, as well as those who were certain to object strenuously to even the least hint of clericalism in the proclamation. The people building the State of Israel, make no mistake about it, it wasn't that they were anti-God and anti-religious. They were creating a new era of Jewish history. They had tremendous pride in their Jewish identity. But part of what it meant to move beyond the traditionalism of the ancient world, of not being locked and defined by the archaic world of traditional life, is to create something that's new. He wanted to be a nation like all other nations. But the compromise was not so easily accepted. So Ben-Gurion thought he could use a word that is sufficiently ambiguous that there are two dinim, right? He chose the phrase Tzur Yisrael. What does Tzur Yisrael mean? So to all of us, the word Tzur Yisrael, Kumabet. What is Tzur Yisrael? Who's the Rock of Israel? HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that means God. And to everybody else who doesn't want God in the Declaration of Independence, what is Tzur Yisrael? What's the Rock of Israel? It's the army, it's the politicians, it's the fate of the Jewish people. Tzur Yisrael. But the compromise was not so easily accepted. The spokesman of the religious parties, Rabbi Fishman Maimon, demanded that the reference to God be unequivocal. and said that he would approve Rock of Israel only if the words Tzur Yisrael v'Goalo were included, the Redeemer, and were added, while Aaron Zisling of the left wing of the Labor Party was just as determined in the opposite direction. I cannot sign a document referring in any way to a God in whom I do not believe, he said. It took Ben-Gurion most of the morning to persuade them that the meaning of Tzur Yisrael was actually twofold. It means God for a great many Jews, perhaps for most. It could also mean a symbolic and secular reference to the strength of the Jewish people. In the end, Maimon agreed that the word Redeemer should be left out of the text, though funnily enough, the first English language translation of the proclamation released for publication abroad contained no reference at all to Tzur Yisrael, since the military censor had struck out the entire last paragraph as a security precaution because it mentioned the time and place of this ceremony. So what's happening? The state of Israel is being born, and literally at the moment of birth, we're fighting. Is this state going to represent a continuity of Jewish tradition and a continuity of Jewish history with its ultimate source in the world of Torah and mitzvos and Batei Mikdash and Kedusha? Or is the state of Israel an innovation in the trajectory of Jewish history? It's a departure from that world of traditionalism. It's a new Jew. It's a new world. We're not defined by ancient traditions. We're trying to create something new. And that's really at the heart of so much of what the tension is about, even today in Israel, which is much less people hating each other and much more so a sense of confidence and a sense of certitude in what you really believe is happening at this very moment. And so therefore, it was incumbent upon the religious Zionist community, and by extension, this ended up being broadened beyond the religious Zionist community, to the world of Agoda, and to the world pretty much until you reach certain extreme elements of the Jewish community, where there was a notion that we have to recognize the divine and miraculous role of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the evolution of this reality, and how to express that. See, in Jewish life, beliefs, we don't focus so much on beliefs. We don't walk around all day just believing. That's not our religion. Our religion is a religion of doing. We need to express beliefs in concrete, manifest ways. There are certain dogmatic ideas that we have to subscribe to in order to be considered within the parameters of a believing Jew. That is true. But very little of our daily life is spent in quiet contemplation of our beliefs. Most of our Jewish life is expressed through action. You have to do. You have to act. You have to perform mitzvos. You have to perform chesed. You have to talk, you have to daven, you have to express yourself. There has to be some sort of physical manifestation of these beliefs. And that's what the Chagim are, by the way. Each of the ideals that are represented by the Chagim are true all year round. The ideals of tshuva are as true in Cheshvan as they are in Tishrei. The ideals that Hanukkah represents are as true in Iyar as they are in Kislev. And the ideals that are represented by Pesach, of Cheirus and what that means, are as true in the summer on Tisha B'Av as they are on Pesach itself. But nevertheless, even though the year is saturated with these ideals as a compelling truth and a compelling reality, there are certain moments that are endowed with a sense of obligation to express these truths in concrete and serious ways. Those are our chagim, those are the mitzvos we do. And so therefore, Yom HaAtzmaut, what happened was, so 1948, there was no Yom HaAtzmaut, because Yom HaAtzmaut was basically the first day of a war. In fact, the front page of the Palestine Post says at the top, State of Israel declared, and then right below that, about the invasion of all of these Arab armies. The first Yom HaAtzmaut, there was no, we've all seen the videos many, many times, right? They're very misleading. They start with that guy with the really weird voice in the UN, right? You know what I'm talking about? That guy, right? No one can decipher what he's saying, right? But then when he gets to, right? And he goes, then boom, everybody's celebrating. And then it shifts right to the same footage of the same 20 people doing the Hora in Tel Aviv in every Yom HaAtzmaut video that you will ever see for the rest of your life, right? And they're sitting there and they're incredibly well coordinated. It's really an unbelievable feat. Clearly they're not at our weddings, right? So what happens? So that's sort of our message. Yeah, that's Yom HaAtzmaut. That was not Yom HaAtzmaut. They went from Independence Hall to bomb shelters. That's where they went. They went from Independence Hall to Levias of the fallen in Gush Etzion. Because Kfar Etzion fell that day. The day before, it fell that day. And they had all of these people who were massacred. They went from Independence Hall to trying to hold on to the Jewish state. It was very precarious. Ben-Gurion, in his own diary, writes, he talks about declaring the state like mamish. He talks about it like he stopped to go to the bathroom. He writes, I met with the military, I declared the state, then I went to meet with the army to figure out our thing. And he looks like, what? Like, take a breath, man. You just changed Jewish history. But the notion then, the sentiment, was one of tremendous chaos. It was one of tremendous peril. What happens? The second year, so they go, the war finishes, they have all their armistice agreements, they begin to open up the borders and settle the country, and now the year is 1949. And in 1949, and it's fascinating, because the committees start getting set up, I told you it's like a shul, start getting set up around Adar. It's only like a couple of months away. And somebody's like, hey, we're going to have an Independence Day. We should probably have a plan, right, of what it's going to look like. So they appoint two committees. One is a more secular committee to figure out, should the post office be open or closed, which in Israel is only a 2-hour differential? Should the libraries be open or closed? Should the banks be open or closed? Right? What should happen, you know, in terms of the secular character of the day? And then they realize the following. They realize that even though most of the country, or a large proportion of the country is secular, the ethos of the Jewish holidays still live and pulsate within the Jewish calendar. And so if this holiday does not entail any religious dimension to it, even religious dimensions that they're not going to observe, it will not take hold with the same degree of character and resonance as all of the other holidays. And they didn't want that. They didn't want that the year should be Yom Kippur, Pesach, Hanukkah, and then we're all off for Yom HaAtzmaut. They wanted Yom HaAtzmaut to have a certain compelling identity to it. So they formed a committee. They formed a committee of the two chief rabbis and of other rabbanim, and they said to them, for the first time in Jewish history, since Purim, they said to a group of rabbis, go make a holiday. Go make a holiday. So we have minutes of the meetings that these rabbis had when they came together. And I want to share with you, they immediately, this is all what you're going to read now in source number 3, is from before Yom HaAtzmaut was established. They're sitting in the months before in 1949 trying to figure out what are even the issues in formulating a holiday to celebrate the historical sovereignty of the Jewish people. So I want to focus on only one or two, but look at this. Ha'im b'samchuta shel harabanut harashit likvoa bizman hazeh yom tov l'doros. Number one, do we even have the power to institute a new yom tov that is binding on the Jewish people l'doros for generations? Im kein, and if so, ha'im b'kocha l'chayev b'kach gam es ha'kehilos ha'yehudit b'tfutzot. Do we have the authority to establish a holiday that is binding outside of Israel? Remember, today, the center of Torah life is in Israel, right? Center of Torah life is in Israel, right? It could even be the center for the Jewish future, might be in Israel, right? The center of the Jewish world is in Israel. In 1948, it was a minority of Jews living in Israel. So the Rabbanim are sitting around and they're saying, millions of Jews live outside of Israel. A small portion of Jews live here in Israel. And we're going to get together and tell all these Jews in America what holidays they have to observe. Do we even have that authority? That was their next question. Ha'im yesh mashma'ut datit li'ra'i histori chapami ke'akamat medina yehudi. Is there even a religious significance to this historical political reality? What was the declaration of the state of Israel? It was a nationalistic political reality. It wasn't Hashem coming and taking the Jewish people out of Mitzrayim. It wasn't Hashem coming and living in your sukkah. It wasn't Hashem coming to deliver the luchos. It wasn't God judging the Jewish people. It was an event of enormous impact and import. But ultimately, the declaration of the state was a nationalistic political reality. In what manner does that have a religious character to it that should give expression through some sort of holiday? Afilu im lo mitnahelet al pi Torah Yisrael, v'roshea eina shomrim Torah mitzvos. And to make it worse, the state is not being constructed around the principles of Torah observance, and those who are the architects of this political reality, this national reality, are themselves not shomer Torah and mitzvos. So how's that going to work? How are we going to have a Megillah with all the heroes and all the villains and all the and the people representing the good guys, the people representing the heroes, don't comport to our basic standards of Torah observance? How is this going to work? So to us, these are like theoretical questions. To these Rabbanim, these were halacha lemaisa. This is as serious as whether or not there is shotness in Uggs. This is mamish dvarim omdim berumo shel olam. This is going to determine what the Jewish calendar looks like for the Jewish people. And then they discuss all sorts of other things. How do we know that Hey Iyar should be the day? Just because they declared independence on Hey Iyar, it was also the start of the war. This was a big debate. Some of the secular people felt, Ben Gurion was like, what's Iyar? Why are we doing? You ever think about that? What all the secular Israelis, Nebuch, their Independence Day, is a date on the Jewish lunar calendar, right? When they call up their friends who live in Memphis, Tennessee, and they're like, yeah, it's Israeli Independence Day. Like, oh, it's May 14th? Like, no. It's the 5th of Iyar, which has its roots in Babylonian. Like, what do you even, how do you even do that to people? So that was a discussion. Halachically, does Hey Iyar have a significance? And of course we know that the problem with Hey Iyar, which is that it disrupts the contemporary observance of Sfiras HaOmer and the Avelos of Sfiras HaOmer. What do we do about that? All of that was their discussion. What I want to focus on, just for the purposes of our shir tonight, was the first question. By what license did they have to establish a new holiday for everyone? Because this gets to the heart of what our relationship here in America, here in Golos, which is where we are, even though we are in Stern College. If you're going to be in Golos, this is where you want to be. But we're still in Golos. We're still in Golos. We're holding by Torah Tzion, but we're still in Golos. So says the poskim. That's what I want to talk about tonight. What is the relationship between us and this experience? What should we feel? What should we do? Is just a day of guilt, right? Which is a little bit what it feels like, right? It's a day of guilt. We're celebrating Israeli Independence Day. Why aren't we there? Well, we planned to go there. We almost went there. We should be there. We're going to be there. We spent a year there. We spent 2 years there. We have to be here. We have parents. We have school. We have we have all sorts of considerations. Everybody's got considerations. I also have considerations. They asked the Lubavitcher Rebbe, how come you don't move to Israel? If you move to Israel, all the Chabadskers will go to Israel. Imagine how many pairs of tefillin would be in Israel. It would be amazing. Why don't you move to Israel? The general leads his soldiers into army. So you're the general, lead. You know what the Lubavitcher Rebbe said to him? You're right. The general leads the soldiers into army, leads the army into war. 100% true. But the captain goes down with the ship. We're all here for a reason. We don't know exactly why. We don't have a plan, whatever it is. But how do we relate to this reality, Bashir Hushan, where we are on Wednesday night? How do we connect to it? So this question, can we establish new holidays? We are not the first generation to address that question. The Maharam al-Shakar, who lived in the 15th, 16th century in Egypt, has a famous tshuva, where he was asked the following. If a community experiences a miraculous salvation, something happens, right? And there's going to be a pogrom. There's going to be an attack on a Jewish community. And miraculously, that Jewish community is saved. Can that Jewish community create a holiday, create a chag, for the community that's binding on everyone in the community and binding on anyone who moves into the community? Maharam al-Shakar said, absolutely. Absolutely. And this psak is recorded in the Magen Avraham in source number 5. Look at source number 5. Mishenichnas adar marbim b'simcha. In the halachos of Purim, Mishyesho dinim aklum yisho ba'adar. If you have a din with a non-Jew, you should try to take care of it in Adar. Yecholim b'nei ir, that the people in a city, litakein, can legislate, ba'askama ubecherim, which means with agreement and with putting people in cherim who don't work with it, meaning it's a serious thing. Aleihem ve'alavoyim achareihem, on them and on those who move into the community later, lasos Purim, to make their own Purim, biyom shenasa bonis, on a day that an ace happens. And if you look at source number 6, the Mishnah Brura writes this as well. A community is allowed to enact their own new holiday, their own new chag. What exactly that chag looks like? Does it have tachanun? Does it not have tachanun? Does it have halel? Does it not have halel? Big discussion, but a community is permitted to enact a new chag. So there's no question that these rabbanim sat down and they discovered precedent, to create and to shape a halakhic experience, a religious experience of Yom HaAtzma'ut, because they argue this was a miraculous salvation. After all, the number of armies that invaded the land at that time and put the community in existential peril was overwhelming. It was similar to Hanukkah. Rabim biyad me'atim. Hanukkah became the paradigm. And just like on Hanukkah, we recite Hallel, and we have Seudos, and we have an Isser of Hesped and Tainis, and we do all sorts of things. We give gifts. We eat those little chocolate coins, you know, that require, you know, pretty much a tetanus shot to open. You know what I'm saying? Then when you finally get it open, it has that like anthrax covered powder because it's like 6.5 years old, because these are Hanukkah coins are yashan. You know what I'm saying? And the older they are, the better they taste, the better you feel, the less you get measles, whatever it is. So what happens? So we try to go ahead. We're allowed to make holidays. So say the Rabbanim, that absolutely we have a precedent for. But the question became, on what basis can we obligate anyone outside the land of Israel? And some argued that Yom HaAtzma'ut should only be incumbent upon those who are living in Israel. Because after all, because this is not just like a feel-good, let's make something that makes us feel good about ourselves and wave lots of flags. This is a halachic reality. We're going to make brachos. We're going to omit tefillos. We're going to introduce all sorts of complicated halachic issues. So this has to be halachically justifiable. So some believed it is justifiable for people in Israel, because for them it was a miracle. The miracle was they were saved. They were saved from the onslaught of the Arab armies. Yom HaAtzma'ut represents a day of salvation. It's like a Hanukkah, it's like a Purim, and that's it. They have a chag. Done. On what basis can they create Yom HaAtzma'ut here? So I want to share with you what the thinking was, but instead of sharing it with you through some of the tshuvas that that are written, I want to share it with you through the formulation of Rav Soloveitchik in his very famous address, Kol Dodi Dofeik. Kol Dodi Dofeik, we just read this pasuk in Shir HaShirim on Pesach, right? We just read on Pesach, we read Shir HaShirim. I used to be a regional director in NCS1. You've heard of NCS1? So I used to have, you guys all talk. I used to have kids who are not religious at my house all the time. So one time I invited a young lady, and she came for Pesach. It was the first Pesach of her life. And I don't know, like I wasn't thinking this through. It was a 3-day Yom Tov. So first of all, I used to have frum kids and not yet religious kids at my house for Shabbos all the time. And the contrast between the amount of luggage that a frum kid would show up with for a Shabbos, especially the girls, and a non-frum kid was astronomical. Like, the frum kid, she like gets to your door, she's holding like 2 suitcases, the father's coming out of the car with like a third, so she's making aliyah. I mean, that's basically what's happening. You know, all for one Shabbos. Now from here, they show up, they have a little pouch, and they're like ready to go. So I forgot to tell her that it was 3 days long, which wasn't good. And we spent Yom Tov together, and we spent Pesach together. We had the Siddurim together, and it was amazing, and it was beautiful, and it was wonderful, and it was tremendous. And then at the end of the second Seder, so that next day, the day after, was Shabbos. And that Shabbos was Shabbos Chol HaMoed, so we were reading Shir. So she says to me, what time is shul tomorrow? So I said to her, you don't want to go to shul on time tomorrow. Shul tomorrow is forever. We have shacharis, we have hallel, the rabbi's going to speak, God knows what he's, you know, we have shir hashirim. She says to me, what's shir hashirim? I said, oh, you don't want to get started with shir hashirim. Nobody understands shir hashirim. It's like poetry, it's like, my grapes talk to my pomegranate, which loves my cucumbers, which loves my melon, which loves blah, 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 blah. Like, no one understands what it's talking about. Over and over and over, the same thing, over and over and over, something skipping on a hill. Like, it's just not worried. It's raining outside. She can't get in the door. She can't get in the door. No one's in the door. She's buzzing at the door. No one's letting her in. It's like Washington Heights. It's like, just don't want to get started with Shira Shira. So she says to me, she goes, well, how often do we read Shira Shira? I said, we read it once a year on Chol HaMoed Pesach. So she says to me, then I have to hear Shir HaShirim. I said, of course you have to hear Shir HaShirim. Shir HaShirim is the most beautiful poetic depiction of God's love for the Jewish people imaginable. Come, let us sit tonight and study together the verses of Shir HaShirim. Right? Kol Dodi Dofeik, it says in Shir HaShirim. God's knocking on the door. And Rav Soloveitchik uses this metaphor to build his entire theory, his entire ideology of religious Zionism. So Rav Soloveitchik talks about the fact that in life, things happen to us. That's called fate. None of you choose who your parents are going to be, what your health is going to be. None of you choose certain circumstances that happen to you, certain parts of your genetic code. That is your fate. Certain things are not in your control. You are the subject of life in that respect. You are passive. It happens to you. Some aspects of life are not your fate, but says the Rav, are your destiny. They're within the orbit of your control, of your choice. You decide what direction you go in. You choose where you want to be tonight. You choose what you want to do. Says the Rav, Judaism believes that one of the purposes of life is to transform fate into destiny. To take what happens to us, where man is a subject, and harness it and point it in a direction where we can accomplish things, where man is an object, where we are propelling the destiny of our lives forward. Rabbi Soloveitchik uses this paradigm to explain the transition from the era of the Holocaust to the birth of the State of Israel. That we endured one of the greatest and most horrific experiences of fate in all of Jewish history, and then from there, it is up to us. We don't know why, we don't know what the reason is, we don't know what's happening, we don't know why this is, but what we do know is we are empowered to do something. with it, to do something because of it. And that's how he looks at the birth of the state of Israel. He has six knocks, each ukodo didofek. Hashem knocked six times. And another time we could talk about all the knocks. The sixth knock is the following. Look at this. The sixth beckoning. These are six ways in which the birth of the state of Israel miraculously changed the landscape of Jewish history. The sixth beckoning, of which we should also not lose sight, because he's at the end, was heard at the time of the opening of the gates of the land of Israel. A Jew escaping from an enemy's land now knows that he can find refuge in the land of his forefathers. This is a new phenomenon in the annals of our history. Up to now, when a Jewish population was uprooted and wandered in the wilderness of the nations without finding shelter and habitation, the shutting of the gates in the face of the exile caused total destruction for much of the Jewish people. Now the situation has changed. When any nation expels its Jewish minority, the exiled now direct their steps to Tzion. And she, as a compassionate mother, absorbs them. What Rabbi Soloveitchik is saying, and this is what the poskim formulating Yom HaTzmaut came to the conclusion of, is that you know what happened on Hei Iyar in 1948? The reality of the Jewish people didn't just change in the land of Israel because the Jews were saved in the land of Israel. The reality of what it meant to be a Jew anywhere in the world from that point forward was fundamentally different. Before that date, if you were a Jew in Europe, in North America, in South America, in Africa, in Australia, no matter in Asia, no matter where you were, if you were a Jew and you were in trouble, you were on your own. But your existential reality changed from the moment that country was declared. Because now, there is no more sheep to the slaughter. Now, there is a country, there is a reality, there is a sovereignty that is taking responsibility not just for the Jews in Israel, but is taking responsibility for the Jews everywhere. And by virtue of this decision, what they essentially did was they drew a line between the destiny of what was unfolding in the land of Israel and the rest of world Jewry. That we are not who we would be here in America because there exists a state of Israel. That our religious and national experience, our journey of Jewish history here in the United States is different, is fundamentally different, because of the miracles that God performed in the land of Israel. That transition had ripple effects that echoed throughout the world and changed all of world Jewry forever. And it changed us because it changed our experience of exile. Our experience of galus, of exile, has never been to be complacent and defined by where it is. The Torah, the Pasuk tells us in Tehillim, let's look at this together, in source number 8. Shir HaMalos, Bishuv HaShem, a Pasuk we're all familiar with. Bishuv HaShem, when HaShem will return, as Shivas Tzion, the return of Tzion, Hayinu, we were Kicholmim. We were, how do you translate Kicholmim? We were like dreamers. What does that mean? We say it all the time. Every time we bench on Shabbos, we say this. Shira Malos Beshuva Hashem Eshiva Tzion Hayinu Kichomim. We are like dreamers. What do we mean that we are like dreamers? So the Ibn Ezra writes, Beshuva Hashem Eshvusam Kein Yomar Yisrael Ein Adam Roe Behaketz Hapele Hazeh Rak Bichalom. What does it mean that we were like dreamers? It means Bishuv Hashem es Shivas Tzion. When we return to Tzion, Hayinu Kicholmim, we will endure an experience that is so outrageously incredible, it will not even feel like a reality, it will feel like a dream. The Ge'ula is like a dream. The Ge'ula does not feel real. It's too raw. It's too incredible. It's too... Sometimes you take a step back and you look at the state of Israel in only 70-something years and you see what it's become. and you see its technology and its growth and its population and its Torah and its society and its innovation and everything that it contributes, not only to the Jewish people, but to the world at large. And you say to yourself, pinch me, hayinu kecholim, show me another nation that in 70 years has gone from ashes to literally the height of world influence. Show me another nation like this. Hayinu Kichomin, in Yehuda Avinir's book, he describes how he was, in 1948, he was digging trenches around Yerushalayim. And he describes that he was with his friends, they were digging these trenches because they were getting ready for the war, and it was the State of Israel was declared on a Friday. And on Friday night, a guy came running up to them where they're digging in the trench, and they said to them, they declared the state. Right? They weren't able to send out a WhatsApp when they declared the state, right? No one knew. They had to, it got around slowly. They declared the state, so the people looked up and they said, well, what's its name? What's the name of this? They couldn't even imagine. They're like, the whole thing was just like a dream. They couldn't even imagine. What's the name of the state? I don't know. I don't even know the name of the state. Maybe it's Zion, maybe it's Yehuda, maybe it's Yisrael. We don't even know. The whole concept seems so out of reach. The notion that they could take this step of Jewish history seems so out of reach. Hayinu kichon. One dimension is we are literally, it's like a dream. It's crazy. That's how unbelievable Geula is going to be. That's what you say every time you read this pasuk. B'shuv Hashem, you think about it. Think about Israel for a moment. Eshivas Tzion, Hayinu kichon. This, for the Ramban, for the Vilna Gaon, for Akiva Eger, for all of the people in Auschwitz, and all the people in the Spanish Inquisition, and all the people throughout Jewish history, Hayinu Kecholmim. This is like a dream. They can't even imagine this. It's so unbelievable. That's Hayinu Kecholmim. The second pshat is the pshat of the Radak. The pshat of the Radak in source number 10. Kechalom Ya'uf. Yihyeh be'einenu tsoras hagolos. Listen to this. He says that what's really going on here is that it's not the geula that's the dream in the pasuk. It's the golos that's the dream. The geula will be so transformative, we can't even imagine a world without it. And we know this. We know this. We take it for granted. We get on a plane, we go to Israel. We get on a plane, we fly a few hours, we deal with El Al, and then we land in Israel. And yes, there are Israelis there, but it's a beautiful country. It's an amazing experience. It's unbelievable. We totally take it for granted, like it's a nothing. And we're able to walk around in relative peace and security and engage all the sites of Jewish history. I was just there this summer with my family. And my children are very into Tanakh. So we, on the Friday night before we left, we gave each child an assignment. And first we hired a tour guide for a few days, Rabbi Haber. I don't know if you know Rabbi Haber. And then we gave each kid an assignment in Tanakh. And we told them that we were going to go to the place where this happened, and the kid had to present to the rest of the family what was going on in that place. So we drove to Yericho, and one of my daughters taught all of the psukim of Yericho. We drove to, when we went to Kiryat Arba, my fourth grader presented the whole story of Ephron in Kiryat Arba. So I run my whole family like a chapter. Anyway, what happened? We got to a place called Kasar al-Yahud. Kasar al-Yahud is where the Jewish people cross the Yarden, okay? So we got to Kasar al-Yahud, and my eldest, her job is to tell the story of crossing the Yarden. So she's presenting the whole thing crossing the Yarden. And I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's crazy. The Jordan River at that point is very small. It's not, I'm telling you, from where I'm standing to the windows is the length of the river. And that close, was a Jordanian soldier. That's Jordan, Mamash, a Jordanian soldier. And in the middle of the water, like right in the middle, is like little floaty things, like you would see in Santa Monica. I grew up in LA, whatever. I mean, I don't, I've never been to the Atlantic Ocean because it's disgusting. But if you were to go to a real ocean, you would see, right, little buoys, whatever, like, you know, sticking in the water. And literally, it's like 10 feet to the no man's land, then another 20 feet, and you're in Jordan. So she finishes this thing, and I'm this spot, I can't believe we're this close to Jordan. So I see on the side, as we're walking up, two Tzahal guys sitting there with their feet up, with some, you know, ice pop in their hand, with their hat, like, kind of like, you know what I'm saying? Like, these aren't the guys they put on the posters, you know, or they put in the social media. And they're sitting there, and they're literally like, so I walk up to them, and I say, in all of my Yeshiva High School Hebrew, eh. I'm like, Zeyarden? And he goes to me, he didn't even like take the toothpick out of his mouth. He's like, yeah, Zeyarden. So I said, that's Mamish Yarden? And he said, yeah, it's Mamish Yarden. I said, and the only thing guarding the state of Israel from an invasion of Jordan are the two of you? And he looks at me, and he looks across the thing at the Jordanian soldier, and he looks at me, and he goes, it's two against one. I'm like, I like you, right? We take it for granted. We take the whole thing for granted. Ayinu kecholmim. A world without Israel. The Golos is the dream. A world without Israel is the dream. A world without Israel is the dream. We can't even imagine. And then finally, the Me'iri. What does it mean? Ayinu kecholmim. That we never gave up in our hope and in our aspiring for Geula. What it means to be connected to the destiny of Israel is it means to be a dreamer. It means to look at Jewish history and at our lives and at our communities and at our obligations and our families and everything we're about as something that's moving forward. It means to dream. Hayinu kichonim. It means to dream of something bigger, greater, more grand. That's what redemption is all about. And in fact, in Hatikva, one of the lines we say in Hatikva, Od lo avda tikvatein, that we never lost our hope. Where does that line come from? It comes from the Psukim in Yecheskel. If you turn to the second to the next page of source 13, the Psukim in Yecheskel, which write, the Yecheskel tells the whole story of the bones. Hashem shows Yecheskel this valley of bones, and all of a sudden he sees all of the bones come alive as real people. So the Navi says, Vayomer Eli ben Adam, Ha'atzamos Ha'elek Kol Beis Yisrael Hema. You know why I did this trick? To show you literally a resurrection? You know why I did this? Because these bones, they represent the attitudes of the Jewish people. Hine Omrim, you know what they say? Yavshu Atzmosenu. What are the next two words? Ve'avda Tikvasenu. Our bones have dried. Our hope is lost. Nigzarnu Lon. Lachein Hinabe Ve'amar Talahem. Tell them, no. Hine Ani Poseach Es Kibroseich. There's vitality. I'm going to awaken you. I'm going to bring you to a new point in Jewish history. There's a reason why it's lifting from these psukim. The notion that we can dream. We don't become dry and brittle and lifeless and complacent and defined by where we are. We don't go to sleep and say, anti-Semitism, it's out of control. Security, it's out of control. Apathy, spiritual apathy is out of control. The discourse amongst people, it's out of control. There's nothing more to do. We are who we are. It is what it is. Hayinu kechon. The entire point of bringing the world of Israel to the more global diaspora Jewish experience is the notion that our very attitude towards Jewish history and towards our lives has to be different. Because we live in an era that has this incredible miracle and this incredible gift. And that is what we are given. That is the opportunity that we are given. I want to show you, because I only have another couple minutes, an amazing concluding piece. Look at the source number Well, source number 15 is a beautiful piece of Rav Kook that makes this point beautifully as well. But let's look at source number 16. This is from Rav Shaul Yisraeli, and it brings us back to the world of Sphira Sapphira. Rav Shaul Yisraeli says, and it's such a beautiful idea, what does it mean that we're counting? Such a weird mitzvah, right? It's a really weird mitzvah. Just count the days. Count the days. All right, I count. You should see trying to, you know, I once, when I was doing outreach, so I decided to get, I used to run clubs in public schools, and I wanted them all to do Sphira Sa'omer, such an easy mitzvah. We'll just count the days. So I signed them all up for the OU Sphira Sa'omer reminder. So it turns out the OU Sphira Sa'omer reminder sent it out on Shabbos. So they're all emailing me, saying, like, thank you so much for the reminder. I really appreciate it. Check out my email. You know what I'm saying? So I called them up. I'm like, maybe don't send this out on Shabbos, right? Maybe. So what does it mean? Is a mitzvah to count, just to count today? So says Rav Shaul Yisraeli, listen to this. It's so beautiful. Said there are two ways to count in the world. You can either count down from something. You count from, not counting down and counting up. Forget that. You can count from something, or you can count to something. This is the world loves to count from something. July 4th, 1776, that's when America started, and each year, let's remember that we are counting the years that we have been in existence. That's called counting from. Sphira Shemimenu. Sphira Shemimenu, counting from. Jews don't count from. Jews, Sphira She'elov. Jews count towards something. Hayom Yom Rishon L'Shabbos. Hayom Yom Sheni L'Shabbos. Hayom Yom Shlishi L'Shabbos. This is the first year of Shemitah, the second year of Shemitah, the third year of Shemitah. This is the first cycle towards Yovel. This is the second cycle towards Yovel. This is the third cycle towards Yovel. We count towards something. We never count away from something. And he explains in the second side, Ein chalkenu ben eila asofim lemedina kederach spirasam shal umos ha'olam. We don't count the way others count. Spiro shem yimena. Lo! Anachnu einenu margishim ki kan sof pasuk l'shifiyosin. We don't view the Declaration of Independence as the culmination of everything, and then the purpose of Yom HaTzma'ut is to just mark how many years we have had since that amazing moment. That's not what we count. That's not Sphira Sa'omer. Sphira Sa'omer is meant to instill within us an attitude that we count towards something. We see the state of Israel not as the end. We see it as the beginning. Reshit Smichat Geulateinu. It's the beginning. And it's falling in Sphira on purpose. It's falling in Sphira to make sure that we don't relate to it as an end in and of itself. It's an opportunity. It's a dream. It's a transition. It's a transformation. It changes the trajectory of Jewish history. It changes our Galut experience. It changes what it means to live in this generation. It changes everything. But it changes us towards something. We're headed somewhere. That's what Sphira Sa'omer is about. I have to end with a story that happened to me yesterday. I haven't really shared this story in too many places. So yesterday, my children, I mentioned before, are very into Tanakh. So they've been part of what's called the Chidona Tanakh for many years. Anybody here ever participate in the Chidona Tanakh? And every year, Baruch Hashem, they've been able to go to the national finals, to the Chidona Tanakh, which usually takes place on the West Side. Last year, I was sitting in the audience as a parent in the gymnasium. And I said to myself, it's not chashuv enough. It's such a gevaldige thing. Kids learning extra, mastering. They take tests. They go to, extra classes. They're like athletes for the brain. They're like mamish, like they're unbelievable. Not chashuv enough. So I decided, I went up to the head of the Chidona Tanakh and I said, let's move it to Y. So we worked all year with lots of meetings. I don't know if you know anything about YU. but it's an extremely non-bureaucratic environment. Very easy to get things done, right? It's just like student finance. You ask people, you ask nicely, and exactly what you want happens right away. So there were some challenges that came up. And in the end, on Sunday, we had the National Chidon HaTanach in YU. Now listen to this. First of all, it was amazing. It was amazing. 300 kids, and these are the kids who won, not the 300 kids who, you know, there were more kids. This is the creme de la creme. And it's in Lamport Auditorium, and they're cheering, and they're singing, and they're answering questions off of Kahoot, and they're friends, and their coaches, and their parents, and we had a Tanakh Yom Iyun at the same time. 250 people came to learn. It was literally one of the greatest days I had since I got here. It was amazing. Amazing, amazing, amazing. So I told you, last night, I moved Yom HaShoah to Sunday night in Passaic. So I show up in my shul for Yom HaShoah, and we have a Holocaust survivor speaking in the shul. So I'm talking to him before I went a little bit early, just to get to know him a little bit. 92-year-old man named Dr. Avital. Dr. Avital was in 5 concentration camps. He was liberated from Buchenwald. He literally stared Mengele in the face while his 11 siblings were sent to their death and he was sent to life. Unbelievable story. He got out of Buchenwald. He was liberated by Rabbi J.J. Schachter's father with Rabbi Lau and Elie Wiesel. He went on a boat to go to Palestine. The boat was intercepted by the British. He was put in a detention camp. The Haganah freed him from the detention camp, gave him a gun, and he fought in the War of Independence. He left Israel in 1950 because he discovered that of his 11 siblings, one was alive in New York. He took a boat to New York, reunited with his sister, then decided he needed an education. So he told me he enrolled at Yeshiva University. He got a BA, an MA, and a PhD in Jewish education at YU. In 1956, he went back to Israel to help fight in the 56 war. When he was done with that, he came back to New York to be the head of the Jewish agency and to found the Chidon HaTanach, which he wrote and spread and managed for 12 years. So I was standing there in front of him and I said to him, I have to tell you what happened today. Today we brought your Chidon HaTanach to where you had your Torah education. Today there were 300 kids studying, learning, competing, growing because of you. That's what it means to dream forward. That's Hayinu Kichomim. When we embrace the experience of Yom HaTzmaut, it's not tension, it's spirit. It's part of spirit. It's because we're counting towards something. In our avodah, is to internalize the magnitude of this miracle and this reality and use that to propel us to dream in our own life. That's what it means to be part of Israel. It means to understand it, to love it, to connect to it, and to make it an animating part of our life. What are our Hayinu Kichomim? What are our dreams? What are we expecting of ourselves in our future, in our communities, and the world around us? To what degree are we going to allow our reality to be defined by the challenges that it presents, the fate that it presents, and to what degree are we going to determine what that destiny should ultimately look like? I don't believe that we live in a disaster generation. I believe we live in a generation with tremendous potential. What's missing is there's so much noise and distraction, we can't see it in ourselves because we are so consumed by all of the data and things and issues and there's so much pulling us away. But if you could quiet it all down for just a minute, you will realize you are the most educated, inspired, actually wealthy, well-positioned Jewish leaders in the history of the Jewish people. And you've been given an icon of what it means to dream big. And you've been put into a moment of Jewish history where we're just at the beginning, and you have the opportunity to be part of building it forward. Whether you build it forward by moving there, which we should all think about doing, or whether you build forward by building the Jewish people from here. But there's no going back. There's no going back to the world of fate. We're in a modality of destiny. We are headed towards something extraordinary. We are leaving behind the dreams of Golos, and we are actualizing the fantasy, what was the fantasy of Jewish history, that has become our reality of what it means to live in this generation. And that's what we should think about on Yom HaAtzmaut. We're counting Sphere of that night. We're counting forward. We're moving forward. Ayinu Kicholim. We're dreaming forward. A wonderful, wonderful.